WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
CBS News Brief. The death toll has risen to over 120 people, and volunteers have joined the search for the missing after catastrophic flooding in central Texas, where more than 170 people are unaccounted for. Most of them in Kerr County. CBS's Jason Allen in Ingram.
People walking on both sides. They're going through the trees. They're looking at brush piles. They might be out in boats.
Hamas says it would agree to release 10 hostages as part of Gaza truce talks. President Trump says of a deal to end the war on Gaza.
There's a very good chance that we'll have a settlement, an agreement of some kind this week and maybe next week if not.
The CDC reports nearly 1,300 confirmed measles cases in the country in over 38 states. CBS News medical contributor Dr. Celine Gounder.
This is the highest number of cases of measles in the U.S. in over 30 years, and we're only halfway through the year. So we will likely see many more cases by the end of 2025.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers sweep the Dodgers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Jackson Chourios singled home the winning run in the 10th inning as the Brewers rallied to beat the Dodgers 3-2 to complete their first home sweep of the Dodgers in franchise history. Trevor McGill struck out Freddie Freeman and two other batters in order in the top of the 10th. He's been named to the All-Star game next week. The Brewers' William Contreras led off the bottom of the 10th with a fly to deep center off Kirby Yates that advanced the automatic runner Sal Frelick to third. Chourios then singled through the left side of a drawn-in infield for his first career walk-off hit. The Dodgers have now lost six straight for the first time since April of 2019. They head to San Francisco to play the Giants. The Brewers get Thursday off and then open up a three-game weekend series at home against the Washington Nationals. Quinn Priester will get the start against Mitchell Parker for Washington. Again, from American Family Field, the Brewers beat the Dodgers 3-2 in extra innings to complete a three-game sweep of Los Angeles. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Waukesha's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. A little angry, furious, actually, because we're watching in real time a coordinated assault on America's working class led by the Trump administration and rubber stamped by the Roberts Supreme Court that seems hell-bent on shredding every protection workers have fought for generations. And look, we've been talking about this for a long time. This is not new, shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, we know. But call it what it is. This is an all-out war, an all-out attack on working people. And it's being waged from the highest offices in our land. This week, the Roberts Court handed Donald Trump and the administration basically a blank check to go in and gut the federal workforce. What they did is they reversed the lower court's order and basically green-lighted mass layoffs across multiple government agencies, from Health and Human Services to Education to Interior, Agriculture, State, you name it. They are all lining up one by one to send out pink slips to thousands of people who just show up to work to be public servants. These are the people who keep our food safe, our air clean, our veterans cared for, our communities functioning. And now, with the stroke of a pen, Donald Trump, with the blessing of the Roberts Court, they're going to slash those people's jobs, going to take their livelihoods away, their dignity. And they're going to do it unchecked, unchallenged, and of course, with John Roberts and the conservative majority on the Supreme Court's full blessing. Now, let's not forget for a second. This isn't just about federal workers. Because understand, I know we've been trained to believe that, you know, it's just all government workers. Workers, in my view, are workers. And, you know, I go back to the Jay Gould quote. I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. So when the wealth class can drive this massive wedge between working people, well, you work for the government, you're bad. What do you get? What do you expect? But understand, an attack on public sector workers is an attack on all workers. You, me, us, all of us. When you weaken unions, when you strip collective bargaining rights and you dismantle the agencies that enforce our labor laws, what you end up doing is dragging down wages and conditions for everyone. You remember the old adage, an injury to one is an injury to all? Maybe we didn't learn it. But there was a generation about 100 and some years ago who that was the mantra. Understand, it's not just a slogan, it's a warning. Because when they come for the teachers, the nurses, the sanitation workers, you know, the heroes. Remember during the pandemic, these were the frontline heroes. These were our essential workers. Now they're coming for them. But rest assured, when they're done with them, you're next. The rest of us, we're next. And the weird thing is I remember during the campaign talking to working people about, you know, Donald Trump's going to be, he's going to be a champion of the working class. And I would bring up his record. Understand, this is a man who, when he was president, before, went after everything he could destroy. Now, as president, back again, slashed the minimum wage for federal contractors, costing the lowest paid workers working for our government about 60% of their income. He's gutted the National Institution for Occupational Safe and Health, the NIOSH folks, fired two-thirds of the staff. So what you now have, if you have minors, firefighters, healthcare workers who are going to go to work every day and be in a less safe condition. He rolled back anti-discrimination protections, canceled grants that were designed to fight forced and child labor, stripped collective bargaining rights from over a million federal workers. He's made it easier for employers to misclassify workers, harder for unions to organize, and nearly impossible for whistleblowers to get justice. And why? Divide and conquer. You keep that working class at each other's throats. You keep them desperate, pliable, and exploitable. Profit, baby. And understand, none of this is a surprise. You go back to Trump's entire career as an employer. It's built on cheating workers, stiffing contractors, and breaking promises. He's notorious for refusing to pay the very people who built his hotels and casinos. He drug small businesses through the court system in the hopes that he would bankrupt them or they would take a lot less. Basically, Trump is the poster child for corporate greed. And if you remember during the campaign in 15, he said, yeah, I do all that stuff because I'm smart. Here's a guy who's always finding a new way to make a buck off the backs of working people and then rubbing our face in the fact that he's laughing all the way to the bank. And now you've got Trump with the Roberts Court in his pocket. Trump's going to try and finish the job. He wants to dismantle Social Security, gut Medicaid, close schools, and basically privatize every single function of our government, anything that's not nailed down. And all to fund what? You know what it is. It's to fund tax cuts for billionaires. More Elon Musks. More corporate special interests, more power to our corporate elites. Because understand, it's not about efficiency, it's about greed. It's about breaking the back of organized labor, silencing workers, and making sure that the rich, well, get richer, while the rest of us fight for the whatever scraps are left over, but also to give them ultimate power. That's what this is about. They don't want workers who are empowered. They don't want citizens who are empowered. Nope. Because what they don't want you to know is that it's working people who built this country. And I'm hoping it's working people who aren't going to let them destroy it. I hope we're not going to let them destroy our government, our country, so that a handful of billionaires and political puppets can get more. In this moment, we need to be standing together, public sector, private sector, union, non-union. Because when they come for one of us, eventually we know they're going to come for all of us. And if we don't fight back now, if we don't find that courage now, there might not be much left to fight for. Especially in this era where AI and robotics and automation and all this stuff are coming online. Because understand, the big, beautiful bill. I guess we're not going to allow states. Remember, the states' rights, people. We're not going to allow states to regulate AI for a decade? Really? And the other part of this, and I think, you know, another part in this trifecta, because look, the media is bought and paid for. The corporate-controlled media is in the pockets of the wealthy, the billionaires, the employers, because, hey, who pays for it? And the Supreme Court, one of the three co-equal branches of government, you would think, we were taught to believe, you know, there's justice. They're not on our side. The Roberts Court has basically become a wrecking ball aimed straight at the heart of every gain working people have fought for in the entire 20th century. And if you think I'm exaggerating, just look at the facts. This isn't just about one or two cases. This is a pattern. This is a full-on assault on the rights of working people to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. This is a full-on frontal assault on working people's dignity. Start with the latest outrage, the Supreme Court's decision in the Starbucks versus McKinney case. The court sided with corporate interest. Starbucks, you know, it's one of those things where you, really? This decision is going to make it harder for the National Labor Relations Board to get quick relief for workers fired during union organizing drives. You may remember the story. 7 workers at Starbucks in Memphis, Tennessee, tried to organize. They got fired, and the NLRB said, whoa, 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 whoa. Hey, you can't do that. That's not how this works. Give them their jobs back. The Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, not so fast to you. Understand, I look back to the Reagan era when they fired the Patco workers, and I've said that's the shot heard across the boardroom. That's when corporate America goes, hey, all out assault on working people. This is a big one. This is the green light for every union-busting CEO in this country to fire first, ask questions later. Knowing that the Roberts Court's going to be there for them. And what the CEO class knows is they don't even have to fire you. Just the threat that you might get fired sends a chilling effect across the organizing drive. Don't ask for too much, or we're going to send you to the curb. And there's no one to help you. That's what that decision said. But understand, it doesn't just stop there. The court just let the Trump administration fire the heads of independent agencies like the NLRB, like the Merit System Protection Board. These are agencies that were set up to be shielded from political interference. You can't fire people without cause. Well, in the Trump-Roberts Court era, where loyalty is more important than qualifications or performance, so much for that meritocracy stuff. It's about loyalty. It's about, did you write the right essay? What this means is that the very bodies meant to protect us working people are right now at the mercy of whichever corporate-friendly president is in power. And right now you've got Trump, who has shown us who he is. And now you, with the NLRB without a quorum, because we fired one of them, or Trump did, and the NLRB is, okay, for now, well, we'll see. Working people have nowhere to turn when employers break the law. There's no cop on the beat. And this isn't a one-off. This is another part of a long history. Remember the Janus versus Aspie case back in 2018? Remember that? That case gutted public sector unions by making fair share dues illegal, even though the unions still have to represent everyone. The Roberts Court knew what they were doing, and they made it clear they want to kneecap unions in every way, shape, or form. They want to make it harder for working people to organize, to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, to defend themselves, to have safer working conditions. And understand, don't think for a moment that they're done. The corporate lawyers are salivating. The Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos lawyers are salivating at the chance to challenge every rule that protects us, we the working people, be it overtime, be it safety on the job, be it anti-discrimination, you name it. The Roberts courts, they're willing to deliver. And again, the Roberts court's recent decisions to make it harder for agencies, like the Department of Labor, like OSHA, like the EEOC, to enforce the rules that have kept us safe and make sure we get paid what we're owed, that's trouble. That's trouble for all of us. And you've heard me talk about the Lochner era for years now. And I've been saying for nearly two decades, they want to return us to the bad old days of the Lochner era. When the Lochner court struck down the minimum wage laws and maximum hour laws and child labor laws, all in the name of liberty of contract, or to bring it into today's world, freedom of contract. Back then, the court said it was unconstitutional for the state of New York to protect bakers from having to work 14 hours a day, every day, 7 days a week. They put a maximum hour law in. And now they're saying it's unconstitutional to protect workers from being fired for organizing, or to let the agencies that actually do their job to actually do their jobs. My only mind is when do we start seeing yellow dog contracts making a comeback? If we're undoing the 20th century and the progress for working people, why not bring it all back? Get the old gang back together. So here's the bottom line. If you're a working person, you punch a clock, you collect a paycheck at the end of the week, understand, the Supreme Court, not your friend, not even a little bit. They're rolling back the clock on a century of progress, a century of progress that our grandparents, great-grandparents fought, bled, and died for. They're rolling back the clock on a century of progress, siding again with corporate interests, with the very wealthy, and doing it at every turn. And as I said a moment ago, if we're not willing to stand up in this moment and fight back at the ballot box, in the streets, in our workplaces, then we're going to return solidly back to the Gilded Age, where you have enormously wealthy handfuls of people and then the masses of poverty. Because understand, the Roberts Court is coming for your rights, coming for your job security, coming for your future and that of your children. And they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop. The Republican Party, did you just see what they did with that horrible nightmare bill? It's time to organize. It's time to put our petty differences aside in the working class and say, you know what? I got to put food on the table, keep a roof over our heads. We got work to do, folks. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think. Or do you think I'm just being hyperbolic? I want to hear your thoughts, especially the people who disagree. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Tuesday, again, this is one of those things you go, can't make it up. On Tuesday, you had Donald Trump who said that he's going to take over Washington, D.C. He said he could run it. Or they could get the best person to run it. Never mind democracy, never mind elections, none of that. No. Whatever highest bidder, I guess, would be it. Claimed after Tuesday's cabinet meeting during the cabinet meeting, wasn't happy with the media, that he ought to make a lot of changes. Yeah. Now, think about this. The idea of Donald Trump, or really, honestly, any president, controlling the American media is, or should be, a five-alarm fire for democracy. Should make us all go, so what? And understand, Trump has said this time and time again, that he wants to change the media. And look, what he's not talking about is making it fairer or more accountable or more accessible. He's talking about punishing critics, rewarding the loyal sycophants, and basically turning the news into a personal propaganda machine. That's what he's looking for. And understand, that's not just dangerous, it's un-American. If you look at what's already happening, Trump's administration has barred reporters from the White House. They've pushed the FCC to investigate outlets that he, well, just doesn't like, and has threatened to yank broadcast license from networks for fact-checking him or airing stories that, you know, he just doesn't like. He has repeatedly called the press the enemy of the people. And you go, isn't that language that would be just straight out of, you know, any dictator, any strong man's playbook? You know, the Hitlers, the Stalins, isn't that the Mussolinis, isn't that them? Come to think about it, you know, Trump did have the Hitler book there on his nightstand, supposedly. And understand, this isn't just some abstract threat. Because understand, I don't think his mind works that way. I think his mind works in this fashion of, he's thinking about something, has no filter, blares it out. So again, not some abstract threat. This is an ongoing campaign to intimidate, silence, and ultimately control our press. Now, the weird thing is we have this thing called the Constitution, and a lot of my Red Hat folks, they were walking around with the little pocket version in their shirts. Never bothered to actually crack it open, but they were carrying it. Because if they did open it, they would know that in the First Amendment, there's the protection for the press. And it's there for a reason. Our founders knew that a free and independent press was the backbone of any functional democracy. The idea that government cannot and must not control what the press reports, kind of a big deal. And the First Amendment protects the press from government censorship, from retaliation, and from being forced to toe the, well, company line or Trump line or whomever sits in the White House, in the Oval Office. And understand, the FCC, for all its regulatory power, they can't revoke someone's license just because Donald Trump or any politician doesn't like what is being covered. For now, it's not how it's supposed to work. It's not how it works. And understand, it's not how it should ever work. But let's not kid ourselves. Our media structure is already broken in numerous other ways. The fact that Donald Trump is angry about a couple of things that have been said that are actually true, while having entire networks dedicated to spewing his lies. This is the result of decades of mass consolidation that have left a handful of giant corporations controlling what we see, hear, and read. Corporate boardrooms, not newsrooms. They're deciding what stories get covered and which voices get silenced. Their main goal isn't about an informed, active populace. No, it's about maximizing profits, not informing the public. That's why you see endless celebrity gossip nonsense, horse race politics, and this both sides-ism nonsense. Instead of actual, real reporting on issues that working people like you and me, we need. And when these same corporations cozy up to politicians, whether it's Trump or anyone else, the line between news and propaganda gets dangerously thin. And when you've got millionaire reporters doing the bidding of billionaire owners, what do you think the minimum wage workforce is getting? Again, a steady diet of misinformation, of anger, of divide and conquer. That's why independent outlets matter. It's why it's so important, why we need voices that aren't bought and paid for by billionaires or beholden to government power. We need journalists who can dig in, question, expose, without fear of losing their jobs or, and this is the big part, or their freedoms. You know, I've got friends who are going, aren't you worried they're going to throw you out of a plane? Yeah, kinda. Never thought I'd say that, but yeah, it's crossed my mind. What we need to return to are local newsrooms that cover city hall, cover school boards, cover what is happening in the neighborhood, not just what's happening in Washington, D.C. or on Wall Street. You know, newspapers used to have a labor page that talked about worker issues. Find me one newspaper in this country that has a labor page that talks about worker issues. They've all got the business section, a section, not just a page. Look, we need diverse perspectives. So no one group, no corporation, no political mindset or ideology can dominate the public discourse. Balance is not about giving equal time to lies and nonsense. Balance is about making sure the public gets the facts, the context, the analysis, so that each of us can make up our minds, informed minds. But how do you make good decisions when all you've got is misinformation, disinformation, and total BS? How do you hold power accountable if we don't agree on what might be the reality? When you've got alternative facts. And understand, you've got Donald Trump who's threatened to jail reporters, strip license, and use government to punish media outlets. He's suing a bunch of them. And he's not just attacking journalists. He's attacking you. He's attacking me. He's attacking every American's right to know what's going on. And the reality is Trump will go away at some point, either naturally or electorally or because he's term limited out. But if we let this guy get away with it, what about the next one? If we let any president control the media, we lose the very thing that makes this country free. And we continue this free fall towards authoritarianism, where the only news you're ever going to get is what dear leader wants you to hear. That's not America, folks. It's not democracy. It's not what my grandparents fought, bled, and died for. But understand, if they're able to silence dissent, if they're able to stop citizens from seeking redress of grievances from their government, what does that mean for us? For years, I've been saying one of the worst things Bill Clinton ever did was the telecom bill of 96. It was almost as bad as what Reagan did back in the late 80s when he let the Fairness Doctrine go by the wayside. And the wealthy elites bought up media outlets, bought up radio, television, newspapers, bought it all up. Because they understood it's a control tool. And you talk to any working class voter, they're saturated with it. Whether it's right-wing talk radio, whether it's Fox News, whether it's the entire right-wing echo chamber. And then what they will tell you is, well, the left's got theirs.
You go, really? Name them. The airwaves are not fair and balanced. We're not getting both sides of the story. And to be honest, it's the reason I started this show, going to be 20 years ago this Labor Day, was to attempt to add some bit of balance to the misinformation, the lies, some bit of truth to what we're being force-fed every day. The reality is working people are getting screwed, have been for decades. The wealth class that our sacrifice has built, they don't care about you. They don't care about me. They don't care about us. What they care about is more for themselves, more power, more money, more control. And if you dare question, well, out the door you go. Whether it's, well, out the door of the job, out the door of your house, or as people have asked me, are you afraid you're going to get thrown out the door of the plane? Yeah. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think. Right back after this.
A voice for real news and great conversation in Milwaukee. 540 WAUK.
As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear for tonight, a low in the low 60s. More sunshine than clouds for tomorrow. Nice day with a high in the upper 70s. Then showers and storms are possible Friday and Saturday. Highs 80 to 85 degrees. Dry Sunday. It's 69 degrees right now.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Trump is again trying to have it both ways on agricultural workers. He says they're working on, quote, a temporary pass where the farmer can have a little control as opposed to you walk in and take everybody away. He's describing feudalism, where the people who work the land are more under direct control of the land owners rather than the rule of law. He wants the vassals, he wants the lords, he wants the peasants.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So again, I come back to this TikTok again. We're back talking about TikTok again. And you may remember January, there was a ban. And we thought, well, they're going to ban TikTok and American companies going to have to buy up the part of ByteDance that's done here in the U.S. And all that. We thought it was done. And then in comes Trump. And, numerous executive orders to kind of move this down the road. Not even sure it's legal what he's done. But it at this point, doesn't look like anything going to get done on the TikTok front other than, well, continuing to dance around and back up and do all of that stuff. And here to share some thoughts on where we are, not just on the TikToks, but also on the tariffs, the trade deals, the big, beautiful trade deals. Well, that's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come share some thoughts. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, great to be with you.
So, TikTok, where are we?
TikTok. Just as a refresher, you know, Congress under the Biden administration passed a bill and Biden signed it into law that required the sale of TikTok to an American company or away from a Chinese company, at least in order to continue to operate in the United States. One of the few bipartisan things that Congress did, right? But they agreed on that. Yeah, as you indicated, Trump got in. Trump indicated he wasn't going to enforce the law, that he was going to delay it, that he thought that there'd be an American consortium that could sell it, or maybe he could use it as leverage in other talks, which I know we'll get to. But at any rate, that deadline is coming and going, and still no sale, still no enforcement, holding pattern. He's told tech companies that he's not going to enforce the ban, so they're not going to be liable if they have the TikTok app on their app stores. And there's all sorts of rumors like that TikTok will develop an America-only algorithm and app that is completely separate from its own offerings. Take that for what it's worth.
I don't buy it.
Or that Oracle and some other companies might buy the U.S. version of TikTok, which of course would require the approval of the Chinese government as well. So we'll see if that happens, or it could continue to be not enforced. But I mean, it's a I view TikTok, I mean, not as a threat to jobs necessarily, but it is a potentially massive propaganda machine.
Not potentially.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
Look, I've said, you know, from the very beginning in all of this, you know, as a kid growing up during the Cold War, I can't imagine my parents' generation, my grandparents' generation, allowing the Soviet Union to have a direct line into my bedroom with propaganda. I just, it's mind blowing to me. And I know we're in a different era. I know we're in the information age, but it is what it is.
Well, and in a lot of ways, it's more threatening because there it would have been very direct, and now it's much more subtle, right? Because the kind of material that TikTok can present to young people, or the subtle messages that are coming through. But, you know, try to talk about a free Tibet on TikTok, right? Good luck with that. Or try to criticize the Chinese Communist Party in any great detail, right?
Yeah.
Good luck with that. And so it is a weapon. I mean, there's other social media similar that's available to it, but they, you know, they've obviously done an awesome job of marketing and of delaying this thing. And I do think the law should be enforced. I don't think it's a good thing for Trump to try to draw this thing out
or the country. Look,
it's harmful.
It comes back to Taco. Trump always chickens out because this is, if, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't he for this before he was against it?
Was. Yeah. Yeah. He said he was for it, and then he realized how many people he could reach through it, and he changed his mind. And it was a calculation that wasn't related to national security or to the whole rationale behind the law to require the sale in the first place. And this is just as a reminder, everybody who is like, what, you know, what's wrong with TikTok? Or what, you know what? I'm perfectly fine with it if it's U.S. owned and operated, and if the algorithm is U.S. controlled, and if the data is not going to China, fine with me. But it is dangerous having a Chinese company that has to answer to the Chinese Communist Party to own and operate the largest, right, kind of like social media, addictive candy that we have here. It's not good.
No, it's not good. I do want to get into some of the tariffs and some of the trade deals, because evidently now Trump, again, you know, I guess we're doing this. We're setting a date. Got that August 1st deadline, I guess, is coming up. But now he's saying no extensions. No extensions this time, Scott.
Well, he said that twice before. But so let's take that with a grain of salt. And sent letters to maybe 15 or 20 of the 90 companies saying, here's going to be your tariff rate if you don't make a deal with us. And wasn't altered a whole lot from the chart that was published, I guess, April 2nd. And so some of the numbers changed a little bit, but not as much. And you know, no one's seen specific paper on any of these deals, so they could be real or imaginary. I do think that the only safe assumption, Rick, at this point, is that there will at least be a universal 10% baseline tariff.
Right.
And there'll be other tariffs that are built on top of that. But that's about all I can glean from this. But again, it'd be nice to have insights in terms of what the strategy is, what the goal is. Is it to raise revenue? Is it to get jobs? Is it to reshore? You know, we're not there yet. And so to your point, you know, the market certainly thinks that the taco, you know, the taco, you know, metric is in effect here, with Trump. So so we'll see what happens in early August, I guess. Yeah.
So with that said, I mean, because you've got Trump, you know, saying this is the deadline, we're not moving this. You've got Trump China that's threatened how did they put it? Resolute countermeasures, I think was the phrase they used in response to the new tariffs. And so the question I come back to is, you know, what impact is that going to have on American manufacturers? If China follows through with these resolute countermeasures and Trump doesn't back up, what's that going to mean for the fall?
Yeah. Yeah. And with respect to China, that's even a separate bucket, right? Because we're back to basically a point where we're allowing some semiconductors into China, and China's allowing some rare earths into the United States. I don't like this hostage trading, though. I think that's a bad, you know, that's a bad dynamic. I think that we have to develop the capabilities on rare earths, both in the United States and where we can, you know, when that's not possible, to do it with our allies, because it's very clear that all of our electronics, our autos, a bunch of stuff, our weapons, they depend on it, and we're still way too dependent on China. And so so that's just one of the sets of issues that's out there on China. But the bottom line is they have made a lot of progress. And, you know, the market thinks that Trump's always going to capitulate if it means that there's going to be massive job loss or massive inflation or that there's going to be a big market reaction. And they know this because that's exactly what's happened. But I will say there is a role for tariffs. There do need to be some tariffs on a lot of different products to help the United States level the playing field. There's no doubt about that. But if you're a business in the United States, you don't know what it's going to be.
Yeah.
You just don't. You don't know what it's going to be yet. So you can't make long-term plans because, you know, they could change. And they have. They've changed more than 50 times.
Scott, they could have changed since we've been talking.
They could have changed.
That's how frequently they change.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's not an effective way to have a mass reshoring movement coming back to the United States or to see upward movement in jobs. And I guess to be fair to Trump, we'd seen stagnation in manufacturing jobs for about the last 2 years. They haven't grown. They've kind of just stayed flat. And part of that is because, you know, interest rates were high during the latter part of the Biden administration, too. But that continues to be the case. And so there isn't this golden age. There isn't anything like it. And part of it is like no one knows what, you know, the future looks like. And that's a key insight you need if you're going to be making decisions about where to locate your production.
No kidding. Now, I got to move over to this institute for new manufacturing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, one of the most prestigious universities in the country. Got this manufacturing plan, and what they've said is our manufacturing our ability here is in pretty bad shape. And they went through and they, you know, talked about, like, my hometown of Cleveland, their factories there, they're still using machines from the 1940s. We're kind of far behind in the technology part of this. So I wanted to get your thoughts on what this group came out with and maybe what you think of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's very complex. And the problem, you know, with a lot of this is that, you know, the worker gets left out of the picture. And so there will be sweeping changes with robotics and automation and AI. And this is going to hit every part of the economy. Right. Not just manufacturing. In fact, we've seen a lot of robotics and automation in manufacturing already. I mean, that's something that workers have had to navigate for a while. We haven't done a great job of adjustment to that. But I think the point that MIT makes is also a pretty fair one, is that we've been behind in technology adaptation. And it's interesting. It is true. China has very low cost labor, like, you know, $4 or $5 an hour in manufacturing, well below U.S. wages. It's also true that China has installed more robotics than any other country by far in its factories, and so it's why they've been able to move up the value chain a little bit and to be competitive. You know, and it used to just be gadgets and widgets and plastic and cheap stuff. And now it's automobiles and it's airplanes and it's, you know, high speed rail and it's, you know, high speed computing and things like that. And so we do need to get our act together. And I do think that at least having MIT others focus on this is good, but the worker needs to be at the center of this conversation
for it
to work.
When you bring this up, because my first thought when I was reading through this story is they're right. Our manufacturing base is in bad shape, and it has been for a long time. And it reminded me of my my former father-in-law, who was a supervisor at Bethlehem Steel back in the 60s and 70s, and he was talking about how Bethlehem Steel kind of fell behind as the Chinese steelmakers were using the newest technology. They were still using stuff 100 years old. And they hadn't really invested fast enough in keeping up, because we basically gave away the steel industry. So I started thinking about this and going, you know, we were told capitalism's supposed to keep us at the cutting edge. And we really haven't done that, have we?
No, and the challenge is in manufacturing that capital costs, you know, eat into profits, into dividends for shareholders, right? You know, because manufacturing is very capital intensive. Like, you can operate a company like Facebook or Meta, and it's very affordable to operate, right? Because you don't have, you know, you don't have to buy a lot of machines, but in manufacturing you do. They're expensive. And shareholder capitalism doesn't like that necessarily. They want to see those profits every year.
Right. They want to squeeze the quarter to legal screams.
Yeah. And so you do need smart things like tax incentives for that and other things. But you also need, you know, companies to get out of the shareholder first mentality in order to make those investments, so that 5 years down the road, that everybody's not screwed. Because that's exactly what happened to Bethlehem Steel and all of its shareholders, you know, and its workers and people who depended on them for retirement and everything else. So that's a dangerous road to go down.
But Scott, I thought the Business Roundtable back in August of 19 did away with shareholder primacy. They now care about workers and communities and consumers, and they care. They do. They said so. Yeah. They wrote it down. It was a nice presentation.
Yeah, it's like there's a lot of great words there, Rick. There is no doubt about it. So, but the proof is in the actions and the investment in the community and standing up new facilities and providing ladders up for workers and seeing some of that investment. And some old habits die hard. There's still too many stock buybacks and a lot of dividend payouts and a lot of profit taking and not enough investment in the future.
Now, I want to go back to this MIT initiative, because I'll tell you, I'm skeptical. I wear this skeptic's hat. When I saw this, I saw MIT, one of the most prestigious universities in the country, with a lot of really smart people thinking how to do really good things on a certain level. But for working people, I'm like, I don't know. Do I really want the really smart people with the really sharp pencils trying to figure out how to eliminate all the jobs of friends of mine who may still be working on those 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s era machines? Would this initiative, do you think, because, you know, this is your world, does this speed us towards automation and the end of employment as we know it? Or do you think the productivity benefits us somehow?
You know, I'm just going to say this. I do think that manufacturing is going to be less impacted by AI than some other industries. And we've already seen a lot of automation and robotics on the factory floor. I mean, even a steel mill, Rick, looks different than it did like 40 years ago, right? And so I'm less worried about that. But I do think that in these conversations, how to both bring in new workers at good wages, and how to make sure that there are career ladders within manufacturing, and also how we adapt to new technology. We can't ignore it, but how do we adapt to it and maintain that level of employment? And that's always been the hardest thing. I actually think that MIT cares about this, okay, based on a lot of other evidence that I've seen. I'd much rather have them work on it than, say, Harvard or Stanford or somewhere else.
Or the Chicago School of Economics or...
University of Chicago or whatever. So I actually do. I welcome this, but it, you know, and I hope they will engage leaders of workers as the project moves forward. I think that will be very important.
Yeah, because look, ultimately, you know, what good's an economy if there are no jobs? If you can't, if working people can't participate in the economy, what good is it to have all of these manufactured goods if nobody can afford them?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this idea that there's going to be some universal basic income and that we'll be working 2 or 3 days a week and we'll have AI assistants do everything with us, you know, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. That seems unlikely at this point. But what we want to make sure is that, you know, that we do have these opportunities, because someone is going to be manufacturing the robot. Someone's going to be manufacturing the EV. Someone's going to be standing up the factories. I want that to happen in the United States. And I think that's the most important thing. How do we get that share of the economic pie in the United States, and how do we grow it? And how is that distributed, particularly to workers? Because even Abraham Lincoln said labor is more important than capital. And so he wasn't wrong about much.
Yeah, but most people have forgotten how to spell Lincoln, let alone know what he said. So, I mean, sadly, that's where we are, especially this administration. So I don't have great hope, but, you know, I'll take your word. I'm looking forward to good things out of them. And I know you guys you've got a podcast going to get these folks on. I can't wait to hear it.
Well, we're going to hold them accountable. And again, I think this key to success is to putting the interests of working people at the center of all of it. That's the only way it'll work.
There you go. Scott Paul, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
You bet, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Our good friend, Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Again, I come back to, I'm a little skeptical, but I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day that went down in U.S. history as the Great Train Wreck. The wreck occurred at Dutchman's Curve in Nashville, Tennessee. During World War I, the train industry was bustling across the nation. Trains carried troops as well as workers to factories to support the war effort. On that fateful morning, the Nashville, Chattanooga, and St. Louis Railway No. 1 train was heading east to Nashville from Memphis. One of the passengers on that train was George Scott. At 18 years old, George was traveling to the DuPont plant to make gunpowder for the war. He was just one of many workers on the train heading to work at the plant. The number 4 train was traveling west. Both of the trains were running late. As the number 4 train approached Dutchman's Curve, it received an all-clear signal from the signal tower. But then, the tower switched the signal to a red stop warning. It was too late. The train was barreling ahead on a collision course with the number 1 train. At 7:20 a.m., the two trains collided head-on at a rate of speed between 50 and 60 miles an hour. 101 people were killed. 171 more were injured. It was the deadliest train disaster in U.S. history. The young George Scott recalled the horrible scene, saying, "I had to raise up the window, and the glass was falling all over everywhere. And I finally got out of there, and I wandered out past a cornfield, best I can remember, and I run across one of the trainmen lying there." In the aftermath of the tragedy, thousands of people helped in the rescue effort. Today's Labor History in 2 brought to you in memory of Carol Hillman, a passionate friend of workers and volunteer of the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So here we go again. The question is, will we ever learn? And this is one of those things that makes me go, I don't think we're ever in this country going to learn. How's the right way to put this? Another scheme coming down the pipeline. The latest move from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You can't believe it. But evidently, this latest move from Fannie and Freddie to consider cryptocurrency as an asset for mortgages, it kind of just makes me shake my head and go, yeah, we're never going to get it. Understand, this isn't just some technical financial tweak that they're talking about. This is fundamental change in how we decide who gets a home loan in this country. And it's got massive risk written all over it. So here's what's going on. Under a directive from the Federal Housing Finance Agency, pushed by Trump's hand-picked regulator, Fannie and Freddie are now going to be told to count crypto holdings like Bitcoin as part of your mortgage reserves. Yeah, if they're held on a U.S. regulated exchange. The idea is that if you've got a pile of crypto, you can use it to help qualify for a mortgage without having to cash it in and have dollars first. So you don't actually have to have the asset. It's rich people kind of stuff. It sounds kind of modern, doesn't it? Sounds like something you heard on TikTok. Sounds like innovation. But let's not kid ourselves. This is the kind of innovation that got us into the 2008 financial crisis. This time, just with a little digital twist. You remember Alan Greenspan going, well, you know, these are such complex financial instruments. We can't possibly regulate them. And we know that crypto is volatile. You know, Bitcoin, what is it, Ethereum, you name it. These things can drop by 75% or more in a matter of months. How do I know? Because we've seen it happen. If you're a working person, a working family trying to scrape together some money for a down payment, do you want your shot at a home ownership riding on the roller coaster of crypto? And what happens when the next big crash comes and suddenly all those assets, all those digital currencies suddenly vanish overnight? Are we really ready? Are we really prepared to see another wave of foreclosures, lost homes, broken families? Just because the regulators wanted to make America great for crypto? This isn't just about risk for families. It's about risk to the whole system. Understand, Fannie and Freddie guarantee over half of the mortgages in this country. If they start counting crypto as collateral and crypto tanks, we could be looking at a massive taxpayer bailout. Did we learn nothing from 2008? Again, like I said, back then it was the innovative mortgages and the products that came out of it, and of course lax regulations, that nearly brought our entire economy to its knees. Now we've got crypto. And the weird thing is again, who benefits? We know who's going to benefit here. It's going to be Wall Street. It's going to be the crypto bros. It's going to be the big money speculators. You know who's going to end up holding the bag? It's going to be you and me. When all of this goes south, it's working people who are the ones who are going to be left holding the bag when the music stops. If we want to fix the housing crisis, let's focus on building more affordable homes, raising wages. Let's focus on making mortgages more fair and more transparent. I kind of think you don't gamble the American dream on digital tokens that can disappear with a tweet. Understand, this isn't innovation. It's a recipe for disaster. And it's you, it's me, it's us, it's working people who are going to foot the bill. You know, I think back to Donald Trump saying, when the economy tanks, I can go in there and buy those houses up cheap. Because that's what the rich have gotten into. This boom and bust cycle has only benefited them. So when you take out that mortgage, you put your hard-earned money in and they crash our economy, you lose your job, you lose your house, who benefits? They do. But I know, Rick, you're talking class war. Yeah, you bet you're behind. Because that's what this is. I want to hear your thoughts. You got any crypto? Do you think it's a right move? Because they're already allowing pensions to consider crypto. The crypto crowd is spending huge amounts of money to influence our politics. It's not good. And if the bubble goes boom, if we see another bust, who suffers? Do you think it's going to be Donald Trump? Oh, no. Do you think it's going to be the crypto bros? Do you think it's going to be Wall Street? No. It's going to be you and me. It's going to be Main Street. It's going to be working people who, again, end up holding the bag. Every time they come up with this innovation, who is it that's left holding the bag? It's working people. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station. This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. At least 120 people are confirmed dead after July 4th flooding, and more than 170 are unaccounted for in Central Texas. Jonathan Lamb with the Kerrville Police Department.
We are actively looking, actively working to ensure that we have an accurate count so that we know who to look for.
CBS's Karen Waugh has heard from Senator Ted Cruz about those who were at Camp Mystic.
The devastation was the most horrific thing I've ever seen.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz visited the camp, including the bunk for the youngest girls.
The water blew out the windows in that cabin and swept all of the girls and the counselors out. Every girl in that cabin is either confirmed dead or missing.
Through miles of flood damage, bodies are still tangled in debris. Police are asking the public to stay out of the way.
CBS's David Schechter says scientists will be looking into what extent climate change played in the catastrophic flooding in Texas.